Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Steve Bourne, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the driftless area of the Midwest. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted as the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve Bourne about fly fishing the driftless area of the Midwest. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com, and start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Steve, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Steve's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And that $20 certificate can be redeemed in person at their shop or online on their online store. Here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in that text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win that prize. Our guest tonight is Steve Bourne. Steve was associated with the University of Wisconsin from 1969 until his retirement in 2005. Where he was a professor of urban regional planning and environmental studies. He has served as chair of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Graduate Water Resources Management Program. Steve has been a principal in the development of Wisconsin's laws for lake and watershed management, groundwater protection, land use planning, and mineral development. He has served as chairman of the National Resources Board of Trout Unlimited USA, and he has also served on the boards of the directors of the River Alliance of Wisconsin, 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin, Trout Unlimited Canada, Henry's Fork Foundation, and Black Earth Creek Watershed Association. Steve has fished extensively across the western two-thirds of the U.S. for more than 4 decades. Idaho's Henry's Fork, most of the Montana famous rivers, Yellowstone National Park, Alaska, Wyoming, and Colorado have been his major fishing haunts, and wild trout have been his favorite targets. Steve has also spent many years chasing trout in New Zealand and Patagonia, and he's also fished the shallow salt waters off the Bahamas, Costa Rica, Belize, Mexico, and Florida for tarpon, bonefish, and permit. But his favorite waters are his home waters of the driftless area in the unglaciated portion of Wisconsin. Steve is co-author of Exploring Wisconsin Trout Streams and writes occasionally for conservation and angling periodicals. Steve, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
It's good to be with you, Roger.
Well, good to have you. And just before the show, we were talking, and yes, in Wisconsin, they are out of winter finally. So Steve has verified that, and we're on to some good fishing weather, huh?
Well, things are really turning on back here. It's a kind of dry fly fishing for caddis these days that even stupid anglers can do well at.
Well, we've all been stupid on the river at one point in time, I think. At least I have. So that would be helpful. So tonight, we're covering an area of the country that maybe a lot of you don't know about, but will soon find out about. We always seem to be flying from coast to coast or down to the Caribbean, but right smack in the middle of our country is some great fly fishing water, and Steve's going to introduce us to that tonight and educate us about this area and give us just another place to go to wet our lines. So, well, Steve, let's just dig right in. Kind of a strange name we have here. What is the driftless area of the Midwest?
Well, the driftless area, Roger, is about a 10,000 square mile area that escaped the westerly and southerly advances of the glaciers. And consequently, while glacial drift, glacial sediments are deposited all over much of the upper Midwest, this area was not covered by that sediment, which is called drift, and hence the term driftless. So the driftless region is an ecoregion. It's an area of fairly similar geology amongst four states, largely Wisconsin, northeast Iowa, southeastern Minnesota, and a little tidbit of northwestern Illinois. Now, the area is bisected by the Mississippi River, which obviously governs the drainage of all the major river systems in the area. And if you were to look around the region at cultural features, you see Interstate 90 kind of slicing east-west through the area, with tremendous trout fishing north and south of 90 in the driftless area, and Highway 61 running from Duluth on down to the Gulf Coast in a north-south direction, providing all kinds of venues for fishing along the way. There are some cities that help form boundaries. Rochester, Minnesota, the home of Mayo Clinic, is a western boundary. Dubuque in the southwest is close to the edge of the driftless. Madison, the capital of Wisconsin, over on the eastern edge, and Eau Claire, kind of on the northeastern boundary. And it's south of, about 100 miles south of the Twin Cities, and a little bit further than that, northwest of Chicago. So it's an area that's within reach of a lot of people. But in that area, you have one of the largest concentrations of spring creeks in the world. There's something like 600 streams in the area that represent about 400 miles of trout water. Most of these are pretty small spring creeks. They may be 30 feet wide. Most of them are not longer than 15 miles or so. There are some that are longer. And not all of them are pristine, as I'll talk about a little bit later. But it is an incredible trout resource, and the driftless can provide a lifetime of trout fishing discovery and adventure for anglers of just about every skill level.
So the topography there then in the land, is it flat or rolling hills, or what does it look like around there?
Yep. Well, you'll get a little clue as to what the trout waters are like when you look at the tourism websites. For example, southeastern Minnesota describes itself as bluff country. And in southwestern Wisconsin, they're the coulee country, and they talk about the hidden valleys. So what you've got is a large, reasonably flat uplands area that's been dissected by a network of streams into the series of fairly steep bedrock valleys, and it's this special combination of the geology and the climate that produced this incredible trout resource. Because, as I indicated, it hasn't been glaciated, and much of this area is right on the edge of where the glaciers were only 10 or 12,000 years ago. You can imagine being back here on one of our trout streams then, looking up at a couple thousand feet of ice, knowing that there were mastodons roaming around the meltwater, meltwater rivers rushing towards the Mississippi drainage, and even the early people of the area were probably watching some of this. So this is quite an amazing area. Since it wasn't covered by all these glacial deposits, the bedrock is the primary control of groundwater and topography. And here we have a flat-lying bunch of limestones. They've really been altered to what's called dolomite, magnesium carbonate calcium-rich rock. And these rocks are 400 or 500 million years old. They are the aquifers that store the groundwater and transmit the groundwater. And it is their chemistry that leads to these very, very fertile alkaline waters that, with our heavy rainfall, recharge all these streams. So it's the base flow into the streams, It's the many, many surface expressions of groundwater coming out as springs, sometimes in some places underground rivers, if you will, emerging, and the topography then of this uplands, flat uplands with these steep valleys produces these groundwater flow systems, which are the lifeblood of our trout waters.
Well, I know for sure Wisconsin has a lot of water, especially when you get up north. There must be a huge aquifer underneath Wisconsin, I would imagine.
All these states have extensive groundwater resources, both in the bedrock and in the glacial deposits.
Yeah, and I can imagine when you described the glaciers being there and yet some areas not being touched, the old Mississippi must have been very full at that time. It must have been a huge river.
If the Mississippi was the prime control on the drainage of all these streams that were cutting these steep valleys down and continue to cut. Kind of funny, Roger, that this area, these flat uplands, which the conservationist Aldo Leopold once called the tin roof of the area, when the European settlers came here in the mid-1800s, they brought their agricultural practices and the plow and began to dig up these uplands. They began forestry on these very steep slopes leading down to the valleys, and there was an enormous problem with erosion and soil loss. We lost hundreds of tons per acre off these fields in the uplands, and down in the valleys, there are some places where there's 10 to 15 feet of sediment just accumulated in these valleys. This silted in the habitats, as you can imagine. There was tremendous water quality degradation, warming of the water, and what was once a thriving native brook trout fishery, which is our only native salmonid here, was almost obliterated due to that kind of environmental degradation and also some overfishing. You can read the old fishing reports of how I caught 75 brook trout today, and here's a picture of 100 brook trout on a stick. It doesn't take too much of that before the brook trout population gets stressed. But the combination of agricultural use and overfishing essentially decimated the brook trout fishery.
Well, in a little bit, we'll talk more about conservation efforts, and maybe you can give us some information about how things have changed and or how they are changing. So, but before we get to that, let's talk about the rivers themselves. What, you know, if we're talking the four-state area there, what are the main, you know, like the top 10 rivers or streams that one would want to fish going to that area?
Yep, well, let me just start in Minnesota and kind of work our way south.
Okay.
If you look at Interstate 90, which goes right through Rochester, and you can stay on it if you're headed out to the Bighorn or headed out points east, if you go 20 miles or so east of Rochester and slightly to the north, you'll find the Whitewater River drainage. There's a 300-square-mile watershed there, and the South Fork of the Whitewater is a real gem. There's a number of the tributaries that are also excellent streams. So just outside Rochester on Interstate 90 to the north is the Whitewater system, where a lot of conservation work has been done, but a tremendous fishery. To the south of 90 is the Root River system, and the south branch of the Root is probably the largest of all the trout streams in the Driftless area. It gets up to being about 40 feet wide. It's a big river system. The upper part of it flows through Forestville State Park, and you get down to a dam operation in the community of Lanesboro, and you've got below the dam a nice catch-and-release section of water, and tributary to the Root system is a well-known stream called Trout Run, which offers some very challenging fishing. Moving over a little bit to the east in Minnesota is the fabled Garvin Brook, very crystalline, clear spring creek, very, very challenging, and that's just to the west of Winona. And if you dip down into the very southeastern corner of Minnesota, into Houston County, you find some wonderful streams in the Beaver Creek drainage just west of a little town called Caledonia, Winnebago Creek, Crooked Creek, and so forth. So Minnesota, in this small little southeastern bluff country area, has a number of both major river systems and smaller, shorter creeks.
Now, before you move on,
yep.
Whitewater doesn't sound like a spring creek to me. Is that? Can you kind of the only one you really identified as a spring creek is Garvin. So what kind of waters are these?
Well, they're really all spring creeks. And they're spring
they are.
In the sense that, one, they're largely dependent on groundwater flow. They have a fairly constant inflow of groundwater at temperatures of about 48 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit year-round, so it warms them in the winter, cools them in the summer. These are alkaline waters. They're very nutrient-rich, and so they help generate all the productivity of plant life and bug life in the streams. The streams are also characterized, depending upon which ones you're talking about, because there's a number of high-gradient streams with riffle pool sequences. They're not all quiescent kinds of streams. Sometimes they're flowing through meadows. Sometimes they're flowing through canyons. But they all meet the definition of a spring creek.
Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. Go ahead. Continue on.
We'll cross the border into Iowa, the Hawkeye State. And the first thing you run into is a series of streams in the upper Iowa River watershed. And there are some absolutely dandy trout streams there. Among my favorites are the North and South Bear Creeks, just tremendous in a state wildlife management area. There's some supplemental stocking in some of these streams, but it's just an absolutely wonderful environment for trout fishing. Waterloo Creek nearby, near the little community of Dorchester, is a gem, and a little bit to the southeast, French Creek. And then Pink Creek, which drains directly into the Mississippi River, those are just some way up in the northeastern corner of Iowa. Those are all in the upper Iowa River system. As you look at the next big river system flowing from northwest to southeast, you've got the Turkey River watershed, and there's a number of these tributaries which are also good trout streams. And then going further south, you have the Maquoketa. And in the upper part of the Maquoketa, you've got a little creek that flows right through the Manchester Fish Hatchery called Spring Branch, which is a classic little spring creek. So there is just a ton of trout streams in the northeastern corner of Iowa to be explored. Across the river into Wisconsin is the lion's share of these streams. Wisconsin enjoys having probably close to 2,000 miles of spring creeks in the driftless area. And the number's always approximate because of conservation work back here by the various states. We've been adding trout waters every year to our registry of trout streams. In Wisconsin, the Wisconsin River, the namesake river of the state, drains a whole host of very famous trout streams, ultimately discharging into the Mississippi. But rivers like the Blue and the Green and Mount Vernon Creek, Knapp Creek to the north of the Wisconsin River, but there's just literally hundreds of streams. As you move a little bit farther north, getting closer to La Crosse, the very famous Coon Valley system of streams, Bohemian, Spring Coulee, Timber Coulee, these are just a classic set of small spring creeks ultimately draining down to the Mississippi. Way up on the northern edge, only about an hour's drive from the Twin Cities, you've got one of my favorite rivers. It would be my favorite if it wasn't so close to the Twin Cities. The Rush is just a marvelous quasi-spring creek, and the Kinnickinnick, which flows through River Falls. These are way up on the northern edge of the Driftless. And then my home water is right outside Madison, about 25 miles west of where I live, is Black Earth Creek, and there's a number of small streams there. And then dropping across the Illinois border, there's a few small creeks here and there as you get over by Galena, and that represents the totality of the resource. But as I say, you could spend a lifetime on these streams, and what's particularly charming about them is there's very good public access, both as a result of land acquisition programs for state parks and wildlife and conservation areas, and the acquisition of access and conservation easements, plus in general, private property owners with notification are willing to let people fish on their land, so there's good access, and they're very user-friendly streams in the sense that as you get older, and maybe you're not quite so spry where you can wade back and forth across the Madison, paddle the Arkansas, whatever it is, these are kind of senior-friendly, user-friendly streams.
Well, you always need a few of those, don't you? We need to take a quick break here, but on our last show, even the young bucks get their waders full once in a while, and Aaron Jasper said he'd filled his three times that day fishing. So and we all take a dunk once in a while, right? Well, we'll come back in just a minute and talk more about these streams and rivers in the Driftless area. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon Trophy Gray Reef and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 307-237-5997. 307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Bourne about fly fishing in the driftless area of the Midwest. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Steve, I know you're not directly involved in the commercial end of fly fishing, but I know you're involved in some other things. And tell us just before we get back into the meat of the show, tell us about the things that you are involved with in the fly fishing world right now.
Well, in the fly fishing world, Raj, I'm not a guide, an outfitter. I don't own a shop. I don't build rods and reels for sale. I'm not selling clothing. I'd like to think I work on the real supply side of trout fishing, and that is the preservation, protection, conservation, management, restoration of that cold water resource. And in doing that, I work with all kinds of organizations and groups all over the country who are interested in the stewardship and management of those cold water resources. So I've wound up over the years working with Trout Unlimited in this country nationally, and even now I've been working on the planning committee for the 50th birthday party for Trout Unlimited in Michigan this summer in August. This is an organization that's built a wonderful technical capacity, 150,000 grassroots volunteers, and I've spent a lifetime working within the ranks of Trout Unlimited. I'm also on the National Resources Board of Trout Unlimited Canada, trying to replicate pretty much some of the things we did in the United States in capturing lessons learned as the Canadians move ahead with some of their conservation programs. In the last several years, I've been serving on the board of the Henry Sport Foundation, one of the more fabled trout streams in the United States, one that's received a fair amount of stress from low winter water flows and competition with other uses. But the Henry's Fork is coming back and getting familiar with that upper Snake River and working with all those people that love that resource has occupied some of my time as well. And then lots of local watershed groups and river groups around the country. So that's the kind of work I do with regard to the fly fishing industry, if you will, working on the supply side with the resource, as well as trying to make sure I get 100 to 150 days of scream in.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good, Steve. Well, I want to thank you for all your hard work in that supply area, because without it, we wouldn't be fishing at all, would we? And it's always important, and we always have to be thankful for people like you that spend their time and unpaid time at that to do those kinds of things. So.
Well, I think we're lucky, Roger, in having a ton of anglers with all the passion and commitment they have across the country who are willing to reinvest and take some responsibility to maintain and ensure those waters that they enjoy are there for their kids and so forth. It's all part of the obligation, I think, if you're going to practice this wonderful sport of fly fishing.
That's true. That's true. We got a message here on the Internet from Phil Panko in Kaysen, Minnesota. He says, "Hi from fly fisherman Phil from the Rochester area. Thanks, Steve, for bringing it home for me tonight. Forestville State Park and the Landsboro area are my favorite spots. Don't forget to mention Bucksnort Dam area with it, the recent improvements there." Are you familiar with the Bucksnort Dam?
A little bit, Phil, and the folks over in the Whitewater area there have been doing tremendous amounts of work on that system over the last few years. And I sure appreciate his willingness to give up some of his favorite places on the show.
Before that, we did have a question from Alan Rupp in Beach Park, Illinois. He says he fishes the Bear Creek Complex, which you did mention earlier, and Waterloo Creek. And I've also fished the Pine River once for the Pure Brookies. Are there any other streams that you would recommend in Iowa in November?
I'll probably see you over there, Alan. Certainly the Bear Creek and Water Lure are beautiful and tremendous that time of year, actually into early December. You might also consider the French, which has a wonderful native naturalized brown population there, Paint Creek, and if you really wanted to take an exotic voyage, cross the border into Minnesota. It's only a couple miles, and there's some tremendous streams there close by in Houston County. I mentioned the Winnebago, Crooked, and the Beaver Drainage there. All of those would be tremendous fall fishing, including some pretty good dry fly fishing at that time of year.
Now, I'm sorry, Steve, I missed the first part of Alan's question there. He says he enjoys going to Iowa after the Wisconsin season is closed. So what is it? What are the seasons between the states? And it looks like, you know, he's intent on staying within a season and can move from state to state to enjoy his fishing. Can you enlighten us about the seasons there?
I sure can, because each of the states has its own arrangements. Wisconsin closes its season at the end of September, nominally to protect spawning brown trout. We've got an extensive wild brown trout fishery. And that fishery gets rested here until the start of March, where there's an early catch and release season that runs up until the beginning of May, and then the general season for trout opens up. So that's Wisconsin. Iowa has a year-round season. So lots of anglers who fish in Wisconsin, who come from Illinois and other places, cross over and fish in Iowa in that fall season and also in the very early winter season in February before the trout season opens in Wisconsin. And there are variable regulations in the state of Minnesota that are stream-specific. Some of the streams have a winter season where there's fishing opportunities. I know it's hard probably for some listeners to imagine fly fishing in December in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa, but believe me, it can be tremendous.
As long as you can brave the weather, that's the key.
You learn to press for it.
You know, we have the same situation here in Colorado where we can fish all year round, and sometimes the weather plays its role in icing up the islets and making things difficult, but there's always fishing to be had.
The one thing I've always noticed, Roger, is that when the betas start hatching or the midges are flitting around on the surface, all of a sudden your fingers aren't quite so numb, your nose isn't quite so bad, and life is good.
Life is good, yeah. Question from Pete in Bolingbrook, Illinois. What are your favorite brook trout waters in the Driftless area? Now, you said brook trout were the native species in the area, right?
Right. This was the only native salmonid. And, in fact, Iowa is about the western range of the eastern brook trout in this country, and they were just about extirpated. I might use that question to just talk a little bit about the recovery of this area, because I indicated that the settlers' agricultural patterns came very close to destroying
right.
the fishery and the brook trout. And most fisheries biologists into the mid-40s and 50s held very little hope for a trout fishery in this part of the world. What happened is that there's a number of restoration efforts. It really began with rural conservation efforts during the New Deal days when the Soil Conservation Service started its program. And, in fact, the first watershed that they put under conservation practices was Coon Creek, just southeast of La Crosse, Wisconsin. And this idea of contour plowing, grassed waterways, buffer zones, and so forth, extended across the Midwest, and so you had increased, improved stewardship of these watersheds. And this federal program was complemented by a number of state and local programs. And then the state agencies and local agencies, Trout Unlimited chapters, various sports groups and clubs, started getting into the restoration business as they saw these streams coming back. And as a result of this work and also the changes in the agricultural economy, we began seeing the restoration of miles and miles of trout stream every year. Now, if you look at the fishery here, and this is partly responsive to his question, the Brookies were the natives. They were almost extirpated. But all these states now have a wild Restore the Native Brookie program of one sort or another. And those headwater streams that are suitable water quality and habitat for brookies. So brookies are making a resurgence in some places. I'm reluctant to give you a lot of names, Pete, because I sort of subscribe to you have to kind of dig your way through the woods to the headwaters to find those vulnerable things, but I'll mention a couple. Crooked Creek in Wisconsin is very challenging, crystal clear. The nice brook trout population, Plum Creek down in Crawford County in Wisconsin, and on some bigger streams, the West Fork of the Kickapoo has a nice brook trout population, some of the headwater streams, excellent. The Middle Fork of the Whitewater, Garvin Brook in Minnesota, and even close to my home, one of the tributaries to Black Earth Creek, Vermont Creek, has a nice brookie population. So those are the brookies, and they're just absolutely gorgeous little fish. I should probably note that brown trout were introduced in the region in the late 1800s. For many, many years in this degraded habitat, it was a put-in-stock kind of program. They grew. There were some big fish. But starting as people saw the recovery of these streams, increased groundwater flows, good habitat, some real innovative fishery work where they began using hatcheries not as fish factories but as a place to brood wild trout. And they would take wild trout from streams, move them into the hatcheries, transfer them into suitable habitats. That has led to the extension of wild brown trout fisheries across the Driftless area. And they are truly incredible. The fish populations in some of these streams measure in the thousands per mile. Now, I know you hear about the thousands when you hear about the Green River and the Bighorn and other big tailwater streams, but remember, these streams are 20 or 30 feet across. So if you see a shocking crew go through there doing fish surveys and see hundreds and hundreds of fish, often turned up from electroshocking where you've been fishing for 2 hours and are convinced that the water is barren, it's quite amazing. So this brown trout fishery is really the calling card of the Driftless region. There's also stocking of rainbows to expand the fishery. There's very few places where there's natural reproduction on rainbows, but they do offer opportunities to catch some bigger broodstock fish and some fish that carry over in these streams. But I think the most important thing for anglers thinking about coming to this absolutely terrific Driftless area to experience the trout fishing is to have reasonable expectations. You will occasionally see pictures of a 6 or 8 pound brown out of a small stream in Wisconsin. That happens. A number of 20 inchers get caught on a regular basis. But you ought to be thinking a good day on one of these spring creeks would be 15, 20, 25 fish in the 9 to 15 inch range, maybe an 18 incher for a highlight of the day. Reasonable expectations. And if looking at those really beautiful little red dotted and blue haloed and spectacular yellow bellied fish, if that isn't enough to trip your trigger, probably shouldn't come here.
Okay. Now, what is the predominant species there? Is it the brown trout then?
It is the brown trout across the whole area. They have flourished here. They can handle the somewhat modified habitat. They're a little bit less temperature intolerant. The brookies are coming back in these headwater streams, and the state agencies are now really actively managing native brook trout restoration programs. But the browns are very, very dominant. And where there's browns and brookies in the same stream, the browns tend to outcompete them. But it is really a chance to come and fish for the wily brown trout with brook trout as a wonderful appetizer.
Great, great. Now, we've got some questions coming in about coming to the area. One is, we've got Pete Suska in Wethersfield, Connecticut. He says, what is the best town to stay in to fish the Driftless area? And I want to expand that and ask, what is the best city to fly into if you're coming out there from out of state?
Yep. If you're going to do a one-shot fly-in from someplace, one of the major airports, I'd probably fly into the Twin Cities, and that would leave you an hour and a half or so north of Rochester, which accesses quite quickly all that Minnesota water down the Bluff Country in the southeastern corner. I would consider flying into Madison, and from there within an hour and a half west of Madison are probably 50 different streams. Wonderful accommodations in both those places. So there's just a whole host. You can fly into Dubuque, you can fly into La Crosse, but, of course, you'll have to get on some kind of a regional feeder airline. All of those places have wonderful facilities, good fly shops. There are good fly shops and guide services in the area. There are quaint beds and breakfasts in many of these little towns. There's an Amish community. There's antiquing and morel mushrooming and biking and all kinds of other diversions. And the scenery will really overwhelm you as long as you're not looking for 5,000 or 10,000 feet of relief along the Tetons or the Bitterroot. Fly into any of those places and rent a car and easily access this area. One of the beauties of the Driftless is you can scoot from one area to another in short order and do two or three streams in a day. It's not like having to drive from the Madison up to the Missouri and lose hours driving.
So that was going to be my next question is, you know, what would be your plan for getting the most out of a trip? So it sounds like either into Madison or the Twin Cities and then work from there. And it sounds like there's so much in either of those two areas that'll keep you busy for a week at least.
Right, or Rochester or La Crosse. And the way I would do that is I would kind of focus. It's sort of like when you have a whole bunch of fish rising in front of you. You don't want to get into flock shooting. You want to pick out your target. I'd focus on a smaller area where there's three or four or five streams you might check out. I'd give yourself enough time. A one-day shot is not enough. There's too many climatic variables. Rainstorms come out and blow out a stream. A stream isn't fishing well. You need to be able to have two or three days, perhaps, where you've got an opportunity to iron out the fishing wrinkles, I guess I'd say. And then I would pick those two or three streams, spend some time on them, get familiar with them, and then I'd come back next time and choose another area.
Good, good. We need to take a quick break, and I'm going to come back to that in just a second. So give us just a moment, and we'll be right back. At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com, and that's dryflies.com, to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Bourne about fly fishing the Driftless area of the Midwest. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Steve, sounds like we've got a couple plans there. Sounds like, too, that if a guy was doing some business in Madison or Minneapolis, St. Paul, he might be able to sneak out a day or so and hit a few creeks. So they're that close, aren't they, to those cities?
Without any question, if you're doing business in any of those major cities in the Driftless area, you can easily scoot out and get 3 or 4 hours of fishing in and get back to work. With cell phones, in fact, you can probably work on the trout stream.
I don't like that idea, though, Steve. I'm sorry. I like to turn that cell phone off, you know, when I'm on the stream. But
I like to see people drop their cell phones.
There you go. We talked about seasons. Is there any reciprocal licensing that goes on between the states, or do you have to get a license in each state?
Get a license in each state, but they're all priced pretty nicely. Iowa out of state is around $50-odd for a season's license. That's year round. And that also allows you to camp at many of their access areas. So that's very nice if you've got a little camper or a tent or something like that. Minnesota's around $40 with a $10 trout stamp. Ours is of the same order of magnitude in Wisconsin. So you need to get a license for each state that you're in.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned a lot of, well, four states and a lot of rivers and streams there. We did get one question in from Sonny in Fenimore, Wisconsin, and he says, one reviewer called your book the best book written by a committee since the King James Version of the Bible. What makes your book different from the others? And what I'd like you to do, because somebody else, Larry Hall in Indian River, Michigan, is asking about consolidated information on the driftless area. So talk about your book there for a second, what that will help people with, and also the other books that you might recommend for them to get information.
Happy to do that. I, along with three other co-authors, spent 2 years. We decided that because Wisconsin was just flyover country, most people didn't know it was there except for beer and bratwurst and the Green Bay Packers, that we ought to talk a little bit about the history of fly fishing, the science, the conservation innovations, the people who contributed to really the fly fishing pioneers who were born in Wisconsin, and people had no idea that was the case. So we did a book that was very rich in texture, and then showcased our fishing opportunities and picked 20 streams, each of them a conservation vignette in its own right, and told the story, but also where to fish and how to do it. But it was not a Mo and Joe fishing book. We're not going to tell you to go to Bridge X and go down 110 yards, put on a size 14 scud with one split shot, cast 18 feet upstream, and strip slowly. The idea here is let you find some of the enjoyment on your own, but it was the kind of book that people could go back and read over the years and really pointed to all the dimensions of the trout fishing experience. And that was well reviewed, and it's been the biggest seller of its type for the University of Wisconsin Press. There are some other very good books out there. One I would highly recommend is a book by my friend Ross Mueller called Fly Fishing Midwestern Spring Creeks. That came out a couple years after ours. There's a chap named Gene Hughes over in Iowa who wrote an early book on Iowa trout fishing. John Van Vliet has a book out on trout fishing in southeastern Minnesota. And for those of you with a literary inclination, many of you would know the name Ted Leeson. You know, there are fishermen that write and there are writers that fish. Ted's a professor of literature at Oregon State University. He's a writer who's a superb fisherman as well. But he's written a book that is not widely known. It's called Jerusalem Creek. And it goes back to his early years fishing in the driftless country that we've been talking about tonight. So I'd highly recommend that, Jerusalem Creek, Journeys into Driftless Country by Ted Leeson. So there's a bunch of books that would get you started. The other thing I would say is if you go to a driftless region and Google that, you'll see that fly shops will pop up. I won't name all the names, but there's fly shops from Madison to the Twin Cities to Rochester to Lacrosse to Viroqua in the heart of Wisconsin trout fishing country. Wonderful sources of information there. Many of the guides will pop up there. And then the local areas, for example, I said that southeastern Minnesota labeled itself for tourism purposes Bluff Country. If you go to bluffcountry.com, you'll find tremendous resources there. So that should give you a framework on getting additional information both on the resource and the fishing, as well as places to stay, other amenities, and things to do.
Terrific, terrific. Now, back to the waterways there. You had mentioned, and it sounded kind of interesting to me, that in the springtime in Wisconsin you had catch-and-release period, and then it turned to regular season.
Right.
So I take it that's when you can harvest fish. Are there catch-and-release areas year-round or fly-and-lure only? Or what's the general lay of the waterways there?
The answer is yes, there are. Wisconsin has some of the most advanced fishing regulations in the country, 5 different categories. They try to tailor the environmental and fishery attributes of the resource to kind of the social demand. So there'll be a mix of things, some trophy streams, catch-and-release. It depends upon the nature of the stream, but we have lots of that in Wisconsin. There are a number of special waters, catch and release areas in Iowa and Minnesota as well, and restricted size limits or total catch and release. So you'll find every variation on the theme, and the fishery managers from the states involved in the driftless get together on a regular basis. So they're sharing research, sharing discoveries about seasons, and it's a very nice collaborative effort.
Now, talking a bit more about conservation, and then we'll get into some fishing here as far as strategies and techniques and equipment and so forth. But I know that this is your area of expertise, so we want to hear all you have to say here. Now, we had a question, Dennis Frankie, or it could be Frank, in Cross Plains, Wisconsin. He says, what is the biggest issue facing the health of our spring creeks in the future? What is more immediately addressable, urban or rural negative impacts?
Well, there's no getting away from the fact that trout streams that are near urban areas are threatened by urbanization because development means impervious surfaces, warmer water, less groundwater infiltration. But for the most part, the driftless area are smaller communities. There are some urbanizing threats. But the big threat, frankly, is from agriculture. That isn't to say that agriculture is our adversary, but just take Wisconsin. There's close to almost 13 million cows in the state. A little bit more than 10% of that population is regulated through confined animal feeding operations and what happens to the waste, which means that you've got 11 million or so cows running around, each cow equal to one human, placing their manure onto the landscape. You can imagine the problems that creates in a big runoff event, leading to oxygen stress and fish kills, potentially over-fertilization. Another dimension of it is that with the ethanol boom and some of our conservation lands have been taken out of the federal conservation reserve programs, more row cropping, more runoff. So the biggest issue in the whole region is really polluted runoff from agriculture. And we've been working with a lot of agricultural groups. There's a lot of legislative programs that have been put in place. But it's a very challenging problem in states that pride themselves on their agricultural roots and lots of volunteerism, but sometimes that doesn't take you far enough to protect the resource. I will say that after a number of wonderful programs in the states, Trout Unlimited nationally started a regional program called TU DARE, Driftless Area Restoration Effort, in 2005, have been working with federal agencies, Fish and Wildlife and the Natural Resource Conservation Service, all the state DNRs, who incidentally have great websites and information regarding trout fishing on their websites, local conservation groups, local governments, working collectively across this region to restore the Coldwater fishery. And Trout Unlimited commissioned a study about 2 or 3 years ago that took a look at the economic impact of trout angling in the driftless area. And the number that study produced staggered me. It was over $1 billion a year of activity related to trout angling by the time you looked at some of the other costs of staying places and buying groceries and what have you. So that becomes one of the arguments. This is an important economic construct in some of these smaller communities. And the resources also are the kind of amenities that folks are looking for to locate small high-tech industries and communities where there's access to trout fishing and scenery and biking. So we're on the comeback trail here, but it's an ongoing battle to try to restore and then protect these cold water resources. And global warming could change things over the next 100 years. You and I won't be here, Roger, but a warming climate that makes Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota a little bit more like Arkansas could really imperil some of our cold water resources, which is all the more reason to do what we can now to protect the most precious ones that we have in the headwater areas.
Yeah, it is truly amazing how only a few degrees in temperature can change a fishery tremendously. So, I mean, we just see that from the tailwater fisheries when, you know, you get X amount of miles downstream from the dam and it's all over basically.
You know, even in the Rocky Mountain region, you look at some of the climate models that have run out there, and not for the worst-case scenarios, but for some of the average-case scenarios of what things might look like in the year 2100, we could lose 30% of our cold water resources out there. So that it won't affect you and I, but it sure looms on the horizon as a problem for those coming behind us.
Yeah. All the more reason to savor and enjoy what we have. Couple of questions again with conservation. We had one come in on the internet. Randy, he lives in St. Joseph's Ridge, and wondering if you knew of any efforts to clean up the Mormon Coulee Stream, and if so, what is the best way that he could help?
Well, Mormon Coulee, if it's the stream I'm thinking of, is a little stream just outside La Crosse, a little southeast of La Crosse, Wisconsin. There's been a lot of habitat work there, and I've seen some shocking there where they've shocked up some humongous trout. And as I say, local TU chapters have been working on that and putting in lunker structures, working with state agencies to create bank cover and other kinds of habitat for the fish. What I would do is either contact the local DNR fish manager or get hold of your local Trout Unlimited chapter. You can go to tu.org on the web, find your state, find a chapter in your area, and talk to them about what's going on to protect streams of concern to you.
We had another question along those lines. J.C. Shepherd, Southern Minnesota, says, how can fishermen reach out to planning commissioners and professional planners to encourage land use practices that protect trout waters?
Yep, this is a big question. You know, most of us, I included, want to go fishing. I sure as heck don't want to spend my time in planning commissioner or regulatory meetings that drone on and on, particularly when the hatch is about to start. On the other hand, the reality is that what we see in our streams is nothing more than an assay of how we use the land. And being involved in land use decisions is just critical to protecting our trout waters and other water resources across the country. The best way to do that is you have to be there, you have to be tenacious, an advocate, you need to have some facts at hand as to what happens when decisions are made that will adversely affect these streams. And it's a question of ongoing commitment, but the reality is, by pursuing that kind of route, we do lots of in-stream work, and tens of people get together and roll rocks and put in habitat. It's tremendous. It builds camaraderie and sweat equity and investment in the resource. But a couple of good land use decisions or a major dam removal can restore and protect more trout stream than what gangs of workers can do over a period of many, many years. So this is a place you have to engage in. As I say, be knowledgeable, be tenacious, represent your chapter, keep other people informed, try to share the excitement of why we love these places and they need to be protected.
Right, and one last question there. I'm not quite sure where Alan's going with this, but maybe you do. Alan Rupp in Beach Park, Illinois says, I would like to know how one would recommend to the state of Wisconsin a stretch of river that I feel would benefit from an easement.
We protect our public lands, and as you roam around in other states, Colorado being a case in point, where there's pretty rigid laws, as you know, Roger, regarding private lands and ownership of the stream bed and so forth, I look at these states back here where we've got very, very accessible trout streams, a very aggressive public trust doctrine in Wisconsin, for example, but a lot of the access grows out of either public land acquisition or the acquisition of conservation or access easements from private parties. A lot of this is done by land trusts and land conservancies, and conservation and fishing groups have been working hand in glove with them. What I would do is if I had an area in mind where you thought a conservation easement that would preclude development or provide fishing access was important, I would get hold of the local fish biologist or fish manager, see if there's a local land trust in the area, try to find a local Trout Unlimited chapter, and explain your reasons for that. And that's the starting point of protecting the land that, in turn, protects the riparian corridors that we fish through.
Great, great, great suggestion. Does the Nature Conservancy play a role at all in the Driftless area?
Absolutely. The Nature Conservancy is a big player all over in the country. Less so in some of our spring creeks, but there are some small spring creeks in the western part of the Baraboos here in Wisconsin, for example. The Nature Conservancy is always worth talking to, as are any kind of statewide networks of land trust organizations.
Good, good. Let's talk about fishing there and get into some more specifics. We did have a couple of questions about equipment. And one just came in on the Internet. I think you answered this earlier, but just to reiterate it, temperatures in the stream. Nick Anderson, Medford, Wisconsin, and also he splits his time into Salt Lake City. What are some of the temps in the streams?
Yep. Well, remember the groundwater that's coming into these streams comes in at around 50 degrees. That's where you start with when you're just dealing with base flow. Then when you add surface runoff, if it's snow melt, ice melt in the winter, it drives the temperatures down. If it's a warm water event and runoff in the summer, it can warm it up. Typically what we're looking at this time of year of temperatures, it will be 55 or so in the morning, maybe warming up to 58, even 62 degrees during the course of the day in the afternoon. And during the summer, some of these streams, particularly in the slower, lower stretches of them, can start warming up to near critical levels of 71, 72, 75. At about 75, it's getting pretty warm for trout, and it's pretty stressful. But, of course, some people will be fishing at night, and the streams will start to cool down as the evening goes on. But that gives you an idea of the range of temperatures. It's a very optimal range in these spring creeks, for the most part, during most of the season for trout fishing.
Good, good. Let's talk about equipment. We've got a couple of questions. Frank in Lanceville, British Columbia, and Bill in Middleton, Wisconsin. Both have questions about equipment. Frank asks, when traveling to this area, what would be the best all-around outfit to pack in the suitcase?
I'd probably pack a four-weight with a fairly progressive or parabolic action, something that could handle both dry flies and nymphs. I like to fish with rods weight from two weights to five weights. I fish a lot of two-weight rods, a small 7-foot, 9-inch Sage light line. Goes back a few years, is one of my favorite rods, but a three weight's a wonderful rod for this fishing. But when the wind comes up, or when you wind up slugging a couple of a tandem of nymphs around, a four weight's kind of nice. And if you're going to do a little streamer fishing or hopper fishing in a windy summer day, you might want to go as big as a five. So 2 to 5 in rod length, from about 7 to 9 feet. If you're fishing largely meadow sections, a longer rod will give you opportunities for line control and be able to get the line over summer vegetation. But in general, a rod in the 7.5 to 8.5 foot range is fine. Any reel will work here. Floating lines, either double taper or weight forward floating lines. One thing, you don't want to have vibrant colors on them. You might want to either dye them or buy subdued colors. Some of these fish are pretty wary and spooky in these crystal clear spring creeks, and they know you're coming from 50 feet. The line is largely a storage system. If you enjoy fishing with a $600 reel, do so. If you want to get by with a $50 reel, that's fine too. But a good rod will make the experience really enjoyable. You can get by with waist-high waders, other equipment. We'll be talking about flies and so forth later. I should mention that you wouldn't do yourself a disfavor to bring along some insect repellent, particularly something like Repel that will handle ticks. We've had cases in all these states of Lyme disease, and so that's something that you might as well not expose yourself to. And the mosquito is our state insect, so that would help as well.
I was wondering if you still had mosquitoes in Wisconsin.
We have 11 left.
You have what?
We have about 11 left in the state.
11, yeah, and they're always on your left arm, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I visited a friend of mine in Milwaukee once, and he was trying to change the light bulbs on the lights along his driveway one night, and for you had burned out, and he would make a run out there and change one bulb at a time and then run back into the house because he was getting bitten so badly he couldn't stay out any longer than that. And I go, interesting. So,
well, it goes beyond that, Roger. Remember that a lot of these spring creeks are groundwater discharge areas, groundwater seeping up around the edges, lots of springs. This is also a good breeding ground for mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Want to be there for the evening hatches or spinner falls, you just need to be prepared to have some mosquito dope with you and also anticipate ticks and so forth. So it just comes with the territory, but the fishing is so magnificent, it's hard to imagine one wouldn't want to do that.
Well, we need to take a quick break again, and when we come back, we'll talk to Steve more about the fishing in the Driftless area. Flatstime Charters is your sponsor for this segment of our show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flatstime Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area and has chosen his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flatstime Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's F-L-A-T-S-T-I-M-E FlyFishingInternetRadio.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Bourne about fly fishing the driftless area of the Midwest. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let's talk about hatches here, Steve. What are the predominant hatches in the area? And I know we've got a seasonal thing going on, but kind of fill us in on what you've got there.
I'll take you quickly through the season. As you can imagine, these spring creeks, it's no different than the spring creeks of Pennsylvania or Montana, tremendous hatches and variety of insects. In the wintertime, of course, there are midge hatches, and along about March, the blue-wing olives, the betises, start to pop out, and of course these are multi-brooded, both the midges and the blue-wing olives, so there'll be a couple of broods during the course of the season, so the hatches will be prevalent on and off throughout the season. As you get into April, the hatch we're all looking for in the driftless area is the Hendricksons. That can start any time from early mid-April and go on into May. The next really big hatch, tremendous fishing, is the sulfur hatch. That comes about mid-May and runs on into June, a couple different mayflies. Along the way, there's a chance for some other hatches. I mentioned the brown drake, which will pop up on some streams with some additional silt in them for these burrowing insects. And the brown drake hatch is sort of the early part of June up until mid-June, can be a tremendous right before dark kind of fishing opportunity. Then as the season goes on, there'll be opportunities in many of these streams for, I'll mention the hex hatch here, the Hexagenia lambata, the biggest mayfly. We may want to return and talk a little bit about that, Roger.
Yeah, let's return to that.
Back to that, but it's not widespread in all these spring creeks. It's in some of them. The trico hatches start very big on many of these streams in mid-July and will run for a month and a half or so. There can be some tremendous trico fishing, and as you get back into the fall, you're busy from the mayfly side of things dealing with a very, very small blue-wing olive. It used to be called Pseudocleon, but now they've changed the name. I won't bore you with it. But these are little 20 to 26 blue-wing olives. The fish feed on them extensively, but they can drive you crazy from a fishing point of view. There's also, during the summer, yellow sallies, and surprisingly on some of these streams, crane flies are a very important food source. Now, there's tremendous caddis fishing. Early in the year, in April, the small black caddis, Shimara, size 18 or 20, black caddis is widespread in these streams. And the Mother's Day caddis hatch is widespread here, just as it is in many other places across the country, starting sometime in mid-April and extending into about mid-May, sometimes beyond. This is some of the easiest dry fly fishing of the year, just great on all these streams, and it can be absolutely spectacular. And in the summer, some tan and green caddis are also around. So there's caddis fishing most evenings, depending upon the weather. The terrestrial fishing can be spectacular. We've got grasshoppers back here, and from about July on, you have great hopper fishing on into well in the autumn. But the other terrestrials, the little ants, the beetles, and crickets, provide tremendous fishing on these spring creeks. There can be enjoyable afternoons in the middle of the summer wading up a 20-foot-wide stream, throwing a little ant or cricket up against the shore, and suddenly find yourself fast to a 3-pound brown trout that was sitting there looking around for terrestrials. So we've got that, of course. That gives you a pretty good flavor of the hatch activity on mayflies, caddis flies. I mentioned the yellow sally as a stonefly. The midges are there, and our terrestrials. And, of course, there's the non-hatch situation where we're looking at the scuds and crustaceans, very, very important in these spring creeks, the alkaline waters, the calcium-rich groundwaters. The chemistry is exactly right, and scuds and sow bugs are very, very prolific in these streams. Probably one of the top food sources for these fish on a regular basis. So crustaceans, and of course we get all kinds of leeches And brook lamprey swimming up, 5 or 6 inch little brook lamprey. They don't bother you like the lamprey you've heard about destroying fish in the Great Lakes. But you can imagine a big old woolly bugger or leech pattern can produce havoc on some very nice fish from time to time. So I hope, Roger, that gives you an overview.
Yeah, it does. Nick Anderson in Medford, Wisconsin, again. He asks, does any one bug stand out amongst all the ones that you said?
Well, as I get older, there are different things that appeal to me at different points in time. Sometimes I'm feeling fairly stupid and inept, and fishing the Brachycentris or Mother Day caddis hatch is exactly what I need for a cure. You love that thing. It's a great dry fly fishing opportunity. But the Hendrickson hatch, if you hit it right, can be absolutely spectacular. Sulfurs are great. And I particularly like the challenge of fishing midges, far and fine, very small flies to sipping trout in very delicate environments. So I'm mesmerized by that. Ultimately, I suppose if I really were to confess my addiction, it's an acquired taste, and it's the hex fishing, which I started off thinking was like a tour of duty in Vietnam, but now have fallen absolutely in love with it and chase it probably 30 or 40 nights a year across the Midwest.
Let's end the show with talking about that. Before we get into that, a couple of quick things on flies in particular. You mentioned just a ton of bugs there, so I imagine we've got a lot of flies to deal with. But we do always get questions. For instance, Gary in Nebraska and Durand in La Crosse, Wisconsin want to know, you know, are there any favorite flies that you have, you know, the ones you don't go on the river without, and could you name a few of those?
Yep, we've all got some of those. Of course, I always hate these questions to say, name your three favorite or five favorites.
Yeah.
Because each of them is a variation on a theme. Take a scud. I would not go on to any of the spring creeks in the Driftless area without having a selection of scuds. What does that mean? That means a selection in terms of a range of sizes from maybe size 10 up to 16 or 18, a selection in terms of beadheads and non-beadhead scuds, some with tails, some not, some subdued, maybe made of rabbit or squirrel hair, others with bright light or antron blended into them, some with different colored threads to entice them. So within the single pattern saying to you, don't go on the stream without a scud, I've now given you 38 variations on so bear that in mind. But I, for fishing on these spring creeks in general, I'd always have some scuds. I'd probably have a prince nymph in a size 12 and a 16 that is just a dynamite fly everywhere. John Barr's Copper John flies, of course, work great, and I'd have those, or a beadhead pheasant tail in size 16 and 18, so that gives you a little flavor for those. Certainly an elk hair caddis or a peacock caddis, a collared hackled caddis of some sort to deal with that. A woolly bugger or a leech pattern, and ranging in size from a big one, maybe a 6, all the way down to a 14 or 15, fishing some little small turkey leech beadhead flies. That would be in my arsenal. And then we have some attractors. I mean, the Adams is another one of these things. Everybody says have an Adams. Well, I'd like to have Adams from size 10 to size 20. I'd like to have them in Catskill ties and parachute ties. I'd like to have some with a kind of a tan body to emulate in size 14 the Hendricksons, and others in a size 20 to be used in a midge fishing or betas fishing. So variations on the theme again. But we've got some special little flies back here. One, an infamous fly in this region, the Pass Lake. It looks a little bit like the western Rio Grande Trude. But the Pass Lake fly, if I were just going to go attractor fishing on spring creeks, this black-bodied, white-winged, brown hackled fly is just a dynamite fly to move upstream with. If I were just looking for a nymph to fish.
Now, before you go to the nymph.
Yep.
That when you say pass, are you saying P-A-S-S?
P-A-S-S-L-A-K-E, the Pass.
Okay.
Lake. One of our good fishing buddies wore 10 different T-shirts that said the Pass Lake Kid on them. And throughout some of the most technical hatches, he would continue to fish a Pass Lake, nailing fish right and left. I always told him his fish were dumber than my fish, but in any event, the tremendous pattern to use. Another one very similar to that would be a Royal Coachman Trude, Tide Trude style, size 16. These are attractors that will really work if you just want to spend a lovely day walking up one of these spring creeks and dry fly fishing. For nymph fishing, there's a couple flies that people might not have heard of. One, a fly called the Pink Squirrel, developed by a guy named John Bethke up in the La Crosse area. This is a fly, a beadhead, pink kind of collar on it. It could either be dubbing or floss or whatever you'd like. And then some squirrel and antron blended together and a couple of little flashaboos or flash off the tail on a size 14 or 16. It's a devastating squirrel here, nymph here, and lots of different ways to fish it. And then, you know, you go on. I've named a bunch of them.
Oh, you've named a ton, but let's talk about, we're running short on time, so I'm going to move you on, and let's talk about some of the strategies and techniques that you use specifically, you know, for fishing spring creeks, since
I'll try to go through it quickly, but give you a little overview. If you're nymphing, and let's face it, 80% of the time or so, the fish are feeding underwater. Dead drift nymphing with a tandem nymph setup, two nymphs, a lead nymph, which might be a size 12 scud, and a much smaller fly that could be a pheasant tail or copper john, or a little betus emerger like an RS2, lots of different kinds of flies. That tandem nymph fishing with a strike indicator upstream, dead drift fishing, very, very effective here. The other thing that's effective is to fish it much more actively and to twitch the nymphs as they come downstream and actually swing them. We're seeing fish, particularly in the early season in some of the lower waters, will respond. Let the fish tell you what to do, whether or not they want a dead drift presentation where you get down on the bottom in front of the fish or whether or not you need to energize your retrieve. So that's what I would do for nymphing, and I'm a huge fan of a tandem nymph rig, at least two nymphs on the line. Secondly, for dry fly fishing, you've got all the different things I've talked about in terms of hatches. So the normal hatch matching, some of it being far and fine for midges and small blue wing owls, very challenging fishing, and of course tremendous opportunities for fishing attractors, as I indicated with the Pass Lake, or a elk hair caddis or a grasshopper. But the idea of an attractor with a dropper off it, hang a dropper 15 inches off the back and a small nymph, that's probably the most powerful combination for a large part of the year for fishing these streams. So fishing attractor with a dropper, very, very good fishing. A little terrestrial or a big terrestrial in the case of a hopper is another dry fly approach to slam the banks. But with those, in all these cases, though, you want to move very stealthily up the stream. Act like a heron. Don't make waves. Don't wear fancy bright clothes that are good for magazine covers but not good for fishing. And just move very slow and pay attention to what you're looking at. And finally, lots of opportunities for wet fly fishing, whether they're traditional swinging wet flies or streamer fishing. There are some very big trout caught here on woolly buggers, various kinds of woolly worms, leech patterns, fish deep in these pools, fish very slow, sometimes with a small nymph trailing off the back, throw it out, let it sink, and twitch it very slowly back through these deep pools. All of those can be spectacular. So there's a variety of tactics that you can deploy on these driftless area streams with a lot of success.
Well, that was a lot. You did a good job on that, Steve, covering a lot of territory there. Tell us about your love, the Hex Hatch, here to close the show out, and what it is, how you fish it, and why it's important to you.
When I came back to Wisconsin, I've come back twice, Roger, from the West. I used to live on the Truckee River in Reno. I used to fish up Sespe Creek in California. I'd fished all over Montana, Wyoming, blah, blah, blah. I came back here. There were all these little cow pasture creeks and little small creeks, and there were no mountains, and I didn't trout fish for a little while back here. And then some friends said, well, let's go up hex fishing. I had no idea what that was. They dragged me by car one evening up to central Wisconsin, put me out of the bridge with my waders and gear, told me where to go, and I slogged about 300 yards through a swamp where I was sucking into the mud most of the time. Pretty soon I was being attacked by bats and mosquitoes. It was night. I think there may have been some bugs out there. Fish were slurping. I was falling into this mud. It was like quicksand. I finally caught one dumb 6-inch fish, slugged back out. About midnight, I was still sitting on the bridge waiting for them, and I thought, I'll never do this again. This is insane. Over the years, the hex fishing, which starts just about as the sun's going down, the hex start to hatch. They come out of their burrows. There's a 3-year life cycle for them. The red-winged blackbirds get active. And these are bugs that come out when there's a hatch or a spinner fall in such profusion it's overwhelming. For example, in La Crosse, right in the middle of the Driftless region, there's a bridge that crosses into Iowa. The big hex hatches out of the Mississippi River are so big that the biomass on the river bridges becomes a danger for traffic, and they bring out snowplows to push the mayfly mass out of the way. That's a true story. So you can Google Earth and find pictures of the hex hatch along the Mississippi drainage seen from satellites. So when it happens, it's phenomenal. When the spinner fall comes back, it's like being under power lines. And in streams where you hadn't seen hardly any fish activity early, even though you might be fishing early on a nymph or an emerger, suddenly as the bugs hit the water just exploses. It's your visual acuity, you're looking, you're listening. Beavers are slapping, muskrats are attacking, bats are trying to grab your flies. On the other hand, on successive casts in one of our hex streams, I took a 5.5 and a 6-pound brown. That's pretty nice fishing any place. And it's a chance to really pull up a big fish on a dry fly that is close to 2 inches long. So it's got its magic to it. There's a devoted cadre of people that show up at night armed with flashlights and mosquito repellent, sally forth into the swamps and await the magic of the hex hatch.
Well, now I got to ask, because it's like any one of these profuse hatches that go on, how do you get the trout to see your fly?
Yep. Well, one is to keep presenting your fly over the fish when it's really a conveyor belt of flies where there's 5 or 6 flies or more every square foot. I'll often go to a much bigger fly. You might think of the fly as being the typical hex fly as being a size 6 or a size 8, a wolf type fly, a white wolf, something like that. There's hundreds and hundreds of hex patterns that have been developed by hex specialists back here all through the Midwest and even out to California and other places. So I won't bore you with all the different patterns, but they're big flies. So it's a question of keep putting your fly over the feeding fish, trying to get the timing right, but I'll often go to a much bigger gob of deer hair that looks more like a baseball than a fly and slap that out there and try to show them something different. Sometimes it's absolutely hopeless. Strangely enough, after the hex hatch is gone, and that's any time from early June into mid-July, depending upon where you are, the hatch tends to move north, these fish are still imprinted, and I often will fish hex at night into August because the fish are still looking up for that great big meal. You won't get as many fish, of course, but it's still the excitement of that night fishing. But I have to admit, it's an acquired taste. But everybody who ever comes back and fishes this area that you might not know, you might not have heard of, you owe it to yourself, if you're here in the month of June, to avail yourselves of some hex fishing.
Sounds good. Sounds good. One final question to close us out here. Frank Lanceville in B.C. asks, and as if we don't know by now, but I'll still ask his question. I know that you travel all over to fish, so can you describe what keeps you coming back to this area?
Well, I do. I somehow discovered I was genetically encoded for fishing at an early part of my life, and I've managed to dovetail my work in fishing, so whether I'm in New Zealand or Argentina or Australia or wherever it happens to be, Alaska, It doesn't matter. I come back to the challenge of these small spring creeks. In the springtime, you sit there and hear the music of the riffles. You'll look up on the shore. The trillium will be blossoming. A deer will be staring back at you. If it's the month of early May, there may be morels growing along the shore, a mushroom treat for later in the day. Small 12-inch brown trout tucked in a difficult lie underneath a tree offers you some real casting challenges. And the fish are like little jewels. And when I add all of it up together, it's the spot I always want to return to, regardless of where I've been in exotic locales.
Sounds wonderful. Sounds wonderful, Steve. Well, hang tight with us because we've got more to do here before we end the night. We've got to wrap things up here, but we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And don't forget that $20 gift certificate if you answer the question right from Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. So stay tuned to see if you win. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn more about how you can help their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest. That's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. And you don't want to miss your chances on our incredible prizes that we have to offer, so make sure you get registered. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So first, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a good organization that spends a lot of time with conservation issues. And read more about the Federation at fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. And I'll go to our database and see what we've got Michael Knagg. Sorry, Michael, if I destroy your name, but I usually do for most people. And in Michigan, so congratulations, Michael, on that 3-year membership. If you already have one, we'll get that extended for you as well. So, and the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine goes to Joe DePinto in Colorado. Joe DePinto in Colorado. So congratulations, Joe, on winning that 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion. And you can find out more about Fly Fusion magazine by going to flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com out of Calgary, Canada. Great periodical that wonderful photography as well. Now, for our final prize, I'm going to ask a question here. You fill in the text box on our homepage with the answer and your name and location. And if you get it right, the first person that gets it right gets the $20 gift certificate, which they can redeem at Front Range Anglers of Boulder, Colorado, and their website is frontrangeanglers.com, frontrangeanglers.com. So here's the question. I'll make it easy on you tonight. The Driftless area covers 4 states. What are the 4 states? Think they'll get that one right, Steve?
I sure hope so.
I sure hope so, too. We'll see how fast they can type because there's they got to provide actually 4 answers here. So I'm checking the website here and looking for someone that has the right answer. These guys are slow typers, I'll tell you.
Huh.
I hope they tie knots faster than this, you know, on the stream here. So who do we got? Okay, first one up is Jim Rich in St. Charles, Illinois, and he says Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota. Is he right, Steve?
I'd say he has it pegged.
He has it pegged. Well, there you go, Jim. You just won yourself a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. What you'll need to do is, in that same text box, give me your name and contact information, name, address, phone number, email address, so that we can contact you and get that gift certificate sent over to you. So, hey, everybody, thanks for playing. We really appreciate it. And, Steve, thank you so much for taking your time with us tonight. It's It was a pleasure to talk with you and learn all about the Driftless area, and sounds like a wonderful place that many of us will have to go fish if we haven't already. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Well, that's great. I hope to see some of these folks a stream.
I'm sure you will. Well, our next broadcast will be on June 3rd at 7 p.m. Mountain and 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we'll be interviewing Bruce Chard, and our topic for the show will be persuading permit. Bruce is in the business of persuading permit to take his fly, and he won't take no for an answer. So listen to the show to find out Bruce's insider secrets of persuasion. We would like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.